To our last speaker, Dr. Marco Ferroni. He's the Executive Director for the Syngenta Foundation for Sustainable Agriculture in Switzerland. He joined Syngenta in 2008 after a career in multilateral institutions and government. Before joining the foundation, Dr. Ferroni worked at the Inter-American Development Bank and the World Bank in Washington, D.C. Dr. Ferroni is an economist and holds a doctoral degree in agriculture economics from Cornell.
There we go.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I heartily agree with the previous speaker that this is an exciting discussion, and it is sufficiently exciting for me that I was motivated tonight late after dinner to change my presentation. I had a presentation about agriculture and water, but in the light of the brilliant exposés by Dr. Gao, Dr. Gopalakrishnan and Campos, as well as many others yesterday, I thought that it was relatively not going to be adding too much additional insight. So I changed the presentation to water and agricultural technology. And I think that the topic of technology, we have not really addressed it very explicitly. By technology, I mean a mixture, basically, of inputs and practices, where the bulk of practices have very much to do with agronomy. And the issue of agricultural technology and how to develop it and how to take it to farmers is, of course, something that is central to the discussion. The potential role of technology in a broad sense of the term is obviously important. For example, if for no other reason but to stave off the business-as-usual scenarios of significant crop production and presumably animal production losses over time that were projected in one of the presentations yesterday, particularly the one by Claudia Ringler. So I'd like to ask you to shift the focus for this presentation a little bit from what we have just heard, which was more focused on nutrition and health, those topics being evidently important, and I don't know which is at the margin more important in terms of developing the desirable welfare outcomes that we are seeking, for example, for the rural population. These things are linked. Now, to ease from what we have heard yesterday, I don't know if this works, yes, to what I actually want to talk to you about, I can say that obviously we've heard a lot yesterday about physical and economic water scarcity. We've heard about such concepts as real and virtual water, and we have indirectly at least discussed what I'm calling in this particular presentation or slide the geography of water stress. What we have not discussed is the relationship between crop water productivity and grain yield. I'm using grains here as a placeholder for basically all of agriculture. Grains and staple foods, including oilseeds and pulses, of course, are the mainstay of agriculture, but as we have been reminded appropriately and repeatedly in the course of the discussion, that is not where nutrition ends. In fact, there's the whole spectrum of micronutrients, for example, that we were talking about, the whole spectrum of the quality of diets, which has a lot to do with vegetables, animal food, milk, and so on. And while the statistical relationship between water productivity and yields in those crops is not exactly the same as what I'm projecting here, it is still, in general, there's a positive correlation. So the higher the crop yield, the lower the drops that are needed in order to produce a unit of crop. If you look, for example, at the, I've got several, crops there. If you look at maize, for example, you can see very interesting that the U.S., for example, which has an average currently yield picture of 9.5 tons per hectare of maize, is the country that shows the best water efficiency. So what we're, and if you look at India, the other extreme, very low levels of yield on average, 2.2 per tons, has displaced the highest water inefficiency or the highest water need per per kilo of crop. So basically what this leads me to conclude, and I think that you probably agree, is there is a premium, therefore, on raising yields. And the question, of course, is how do we raise yields? But before I get into that, and that's really the gist of my presentation, I want to just recall, because sometimes I find myself in a situation where I need to explain or I'm asked the question, why do we need to raise yields? Well, in the first place, to produce food at prices that consumers can afford. In the second place, we have seen in the presentation by Dr. Solomons that where there is a high degree of simultaneity between on-farm production and on-farm consumption of that same production, there is actually a direct link, not only an indirect link, as we have heard in some of the presentations yesterday, and I think Victoria mentioned that also, between production and nutritional outcomes and health, nutritional outcomes. There's also the need to create the basis for income gains in agriculture through productivity improvement. There's the need to conserve natural resources. We want to conserve forests, water, land, biodiversity. We talked about biodiversity yesterday. And one wants to reduce greenhouse gas emissions deriving from agriculture. Agriculture per se, at current levels of productivity, is responsible for 14% of greenhouse gas emissions. A colleague of mine recently suggested to me, well, maybe that's not very much for feeding humanity. But if we include land use change, and land use change is basically encroachment into forests, which is enforced by the lack of, by the low yields that we have, then, of course, greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture plus land use change, direct and indirect, that is, reach something like 33%, and that's already pretty significant. So how to raise yields? And there are many issues, some of which have been discussed here. Plant breeding, in other words, really this is about, at some significant measure, it's about science and technology. And one aspect in science and technology has to do with plant breeding, which can be plant breeding as well as genetic modification. What I want to show in this particular slide is that drought tolerance, which is clearly one of the holy grails in plant breeding today and going forward as climate change predictions will kick in. This is going to be a mainstay of plant breeding for many, 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 many years to come. Drought tolerance is a complex problem. It's not a single gene issue, such as and it doesn't necessarily lend itself easily to transgenic approaches. There's a lot of work being done on native traits. Fortunately, it is the case that so far in our major crop, food crops, only a very small fraction of the total genetic variation has been exploited. That bodes well. But there is a lot of research that needs to be done with respect to finding out the function of genes. And since we are here in a university setting, those of you who operate in that field, I would encourage McGill to produce more work in terms of discovery on the function of genes as relevant to the question of drought tolerance. Of course, if you have a situation like a drought like we saw pictures of in Guatemala, there's not very much that drought tolerance can do because plants need water. And I think that in 100 years and 200 years, there's not going to be any way around that reality. But the question is, what can be done in order to raise tolerance? And then there's a second exciting and relatively new area of work, which is crop enhancement chemistry, which is about triggers that trigger natural pathways for improved vigor, water use efficiency, and again, drought tolerance. I'm not going to go into this. And then there are many solutions which are beyond chemicals and seeds, and they have to do with agronomy and management, on-farm water use, water delivery systems, water intelligence, physical protection, soil additives, ag practices, and so on. At some level, it's all about closing yield gaps. Grain yields in Africa are about 1 ton per hectare. In India, they're, as we've seen for maize, 2.5 tons per hectare. In China, they're twice that level. In Brazil, they're 8 tons per hectare. In the U.S., Canada, 9 to 10 tons. So that shows you the yield gaps. Yield gap is defined as the difference between realized productivity and the best that can be achieved with current genetic material and available technologies and management. And yield is a function of a farmer's capacity to access and use seeds, water, nutrients, pest, disease, weed management, soils, biodiversity, and knowledge. And, of course, there are other determinants of investment and yield: market conditions, government policies, farmer health, finance, risk tools, insurance, post-harvest technology, the profitability of alternative uses of land, labor, and capital, all of that plays into the picture. I have a second projection here on the matter of yield gaps. Farm capability as an additive progression. I think of farmers and farming in developing countries as taking place on a continuum of farm capability from very low and very limited and rudimentary farm capability and the technological responses that can appropriately be recommended are dependent. They're not independent of farm capability. They need to be taking into account farm capability and the managerial knowledge and financial absorption capacity of farms. So at low capability in smallholder farming, the most important knowledge that we're finding, that we keep coming across in extension programs that partners that work with us and we work with them identify has to do with knowledge, has to do with improved agronomic practices. That is more important. That is a prior problem before we need improved seeds. The next item is soil and water management. Robust seeds, which at that level of capability are more likely going to be open pollinated varieties than hybrids and fancier seeds that require ancillary inputs in order for them to bring out their yield potential, manure use, etc. At higher levels, you've got oftentimes the interest on the part of farmers, and it is appropriate to do so, basic crop protection to be introduced. Herbicide is typically the first item that will come into play, etc. Hybrid seeds, multi-trait hybrids, including GM traits, etc., are of relevance at higher levels of capability. Now, I was talking about how do we raise yields, and I think that one aspect also, beyond what I've just said, is being open-minded when it comes to technology. We have addressed some of the issues yesterday. There's a lot of doomsaying going on in rich countries when it comes to what the agricultural potential is in developing countries. The potential is very significant, and farmers will rise to the occasion if given half a chance, which means incentives, institutions, infrastructure, and so on. There's a false choice debate about environment versus technology. We can have a long discussion about organic farming, for example, and they think we should just be basically open-minded. Our foundation is supporting a large program in the northeast of Brazil that links assentados, which are beneficiaries of previous land reform episodes, to organic production and the development of value chains for organic high-value crops, nuts, meats, vegetables, medicinal plants, and so on. But on the other hand, I know that you cannot feed the world at the affordable prices that you want, and if you're interested in poverty reduction, without using all of the modern arsenal of inputs, and that includes agrochemistry. And we can be very happy to talk about that in more detail. There's an issue about food sovereignty that really I find affects the way we discuss agriculture in OECD countries, including our host country here, but certainly my country where I in Europe and so on. And that is, I have a lot of sympathy for low food miles, whole foods, soul food, functional food, etc. It makes you feel good. However, if we go the route of food sovereignty, we're hurting developing countries who need market access in those strands of economic production where they have something to offer, which typically at lower levels of economic development is by definition agricultural produce. And furthermore, the exporting countries that in recent times, including this year, restricted exports, what did they do? They practiced food sovereignty. And what were the effect? Well, the effect is that they practiced food sovereignty on the backs of their own agricultural population and at the cost of importers, of consumers in importing countries. The poverty rhetoric leading us astray, we have a huge amount of, I'm not going to be very explicit about context where I find this all the time, where people talk about the need for poverty reduction, etc. Let's just raise yields. That will be poverty reducing downright. Peasant romanticism. Farmers, small farmers, the millions, 450 million according to the existing censuses, by the way, of small farmers at less than two hectares, will need to move off the farm by definition. That's the definition of economic development, the large majority of them. So you will be seeing farm consolidation and so on. But in order to get there, you need to, given the limited urban labor absorption or non-agricultural labor absorption capability, you will need to pass through an intense period that was going to be decades to come of agricultural intensification. The rejection of ownership, this gets us into discussion of the private sector. I think I'm going to, since my chairman is saying that I'm running out of time, I'm not going to say more about this, but except to say, make one statement, because I think that should be, we should keep that in mind. Let's look at agricultural R&D. And let's look at the role of the public and the private sector in agricultural R&D. Well, the public sector has an important role, in particular in non-commercial crops, focused basically as it is on plant breeding. The public sector has massively declined its investment in ag research and therefore its capability in that particular activity, with one exception globally, and that exception is China. And the public sector is not particularly good at taking products to the market, which is why we have, as Florence mentioned earlier, dozens of improved, fully bred, improved crop varieties, for example, in Africa, that are on the shelves of national agricultural programs that have not made it so far into farmers' fields. Now, what about the private sector? The private sector is good at taking products to the market. The private sector has increased massively in recent years, and I see this continuing, investment in ag research and therefore in crop science capability. Private sector is focused on a broader spectrum on ag technologies, broader than the public sector, including not only genetics, but also chemistry, fertilizer, mechanization, implements, connectivity, and so on. You knew that cell phones, for example, are an agricultural input. But the private sector has no incentive to go where there is not a business case. So how can you bring these two capabilities together to generate resources for that are relevant for smallholder farmers? That's the question, and that is what leads us to PPPs. Now, if I talk to consumers in rich countries, these are the issues that come up. If I talk to farmers anywhere in the world, rich and poor, large or small, women or men farmers, they want three things: technology, services, and access to markets. Now, back to the private sector. Basically, it is the private sector that can deliver en masse. And we just got done mentioning that there are about 450 million smallholder farmers out there, bulk of them in China, India, South Asia, more generally Asia in general, and then a number of them, 60 million, 70 million or so in Africa. My cutoff point is up to 2 hectares. And, you know, we can reach thousands of farmers through projects. But we cannot reach the millions that need to be reached through projects. They can only be reached through markets. And so there is a very important role for the public sector. There is a role for the private sector, as just explained. There is a role for the foundations, the third sector. We find ourselves particularly well-placed to broker PPPs between for-profit entities and not-for-profit ag research institutes where the objective is to generate resources that are relevant to pre-commercial, as we use that term, smallholder farmers. And there is a role for partnerships. Those partnerships have two functions in agriculture: synergies in R&D and tweak markets into existence. Defying convention, there is great scope in disruptive technologies, and I see them coming from the private sector, whether we like it or not, information technology, mobile applications, etc., etc. Nanotech, engineering, also on the soft side, management side, new business models for service delivery, and so on. Working towards innovation commons and PPPs in agricultural R&D. I'm not going to go through this, but I want to say something about, and then I'll stop, Mr. Chairman. I want to say something about developing input markets, seed markets. I could talk to you about fertilizer markets, markets for agrochemicals, markets for financial instruments, and markets for the whole gamut of inputs, if you wish. But the basic point is this, and it can be exemplified by referring to seed markets. These markets, under the conditions that we're typically talking about, do not come about spontaneously. They require a push, which typically has to come from some non-profit source, whether it's the public sector or the NGOs or the foundations sector or what it may be. And this can be very well explained by reference to seed markets. History shows that a private seed industry is essential for rapid and widespread productivity gains in agriculture. In the US, this has happened since the 1930s. Today, and that's true also obviously for Canada, private sector seed market share is about 100%. In Europe, we've seen this effect, this tendency in effect since the 1950s, Asia from the late 1960s, and Latin America from the 70s. In Africa, it is supposed to and must happen now. This is a stylistic representation of the Indian seed market, where you can see how the Indian seed market development is really one gigantic PPP that has been in operation for 40 to 50 years, and it is now to a very significant degree private, and you have a situation where private seed companies are reaching millions of what you would call resource-poor smallholder farmers. Potato seed market in Kenya, this is something our foundation has been associated with. Index insurance to kickstart input markets, I will be very brief. This is a product that our foundation has developed together with a commercial insurance company, UAP Insurance Company in Kenya, that operates also in other countries in East Africa. And what's the deal here? Already several speakers previously talked about agriculture being a risky business. If you cannot hedge risk, then you cannot invest, because you cannot afford losing your investment if cash is your scarcest commodity as a smallholder farmer. Now, there are on-farm ways of managing risk, and they have a lot to do with technology and management. There are community-based ways of managing risk, and they have to do a lot. They have a lot to do with social organization and reciprocity arrangements. And then there are covariate risks that are large, where the losses can be large in relation to the assets that the farm household has, and they can only be dealt with through market pooling of risk, and that is where insurance comes in. That's all I'll say about this. But the point is this: insurance is a major, major tool to create conditions that enable farmers to invest. It's not only about inputs, it's also about the value chain. Mr. Terry talked about Farm Africa and the corridor example. I'm not going to go into this. And my last slide is this one, beekeeping in Uganda. This is about food security. This is about cash crops. Other speakers mentioned cash crops. Cash crops are essential to food security, because you cannot live without money. And I spoke last week, 10 days ago, with the managing director of beekeeping of this particular firm in Uganda. The lady was saying to me, you know, I could sell five times, six times, seven times the amount of honey that I can offer currently on the market if only I could generate more production, if only I could develop the producer. She already works with 250 beekeepers, producer associations. She says, I could absorb. She now has gotten clearance to export, for example, to Europe. I could absorb a lot more honey, but I cannot afford at the level of my, given the size of my business, where she is on the J-curve, to invest more money in the short run in producing, in developing the producer. So developing the producer is a central aspect. And so the fabric of food security and agricultural growth, it doesn't just have to do with inputs and technology, it has to do with outputs and markets. And the driving causative thing basically is markets, because inputs requires wherewithal to buy them. That is only possible if you've got something to sell. So it is the creation of the post of value post-harvest. That is really what shapes the fate of the input industry as well as farmers. But then entrepreneurship post-harvest is not possible without the empowerment and the development of farmers. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm sorry for having gone over my time, and that was what I wanted to say. Parting thought, consider lowering your water footprint.